This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Today I'm talking to Mark Chiasano. He's the author of a book called Marine Park. It's a collection of stories, and descriptively enough, the title covers the location of most of where the stories take place. Not all of them, but it's also where you grew up, Mark. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for having me here, David.
Oh, that's great. This is a wonderful collection of stories. I think the writing is really good. I like the book a lot. And, you know, I like short stories, but I find myself not often reading short stories as much as I might want to.
You know, even when I read short stories, I feel like most short story collections, I'll like to read a couple of the stories and then put them down. Right. It's hard to read straight through.
Right.
So but I'm impressed that you made it all the way.
No, it's a great collection. And, you know, I think also people have looked at short stories as kind of the practicing ground for writing longer pieces.
Yeah.
Most, you know, in the heyday of short stories, which was probably the 1920s and 30s, there were a lot of short story writers. They didn't necessarily have to feel the pressure to write novels. But today, I think for commercial reasons, everybody feels like they have to write a novel. Mm-hmm. So I will have to ask you that question, you know, are you working on a novel?
Fair enough. No, I think the 20s and 30s was definitely the heyday economically anyway. There were definitely a lot of places for it.
Right.
But I think it could happen again. It's sort of short stories are more suited for our short attention spans now.
Exactly. So, I know. I think that's true. Yeah. So when you first started writing, how old were you?
Writing generally?
Yeah, feeling like you were writing fiction for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing for a long time, I guess, but most of it was terrible. And then I took a couple of classes in college, and I guess that's when I started writing in a serious way. I actually heard the writer Dennis Johnson speak once when I was in college, and someone asked him something about his process, and he said that he writes for 2 minutes every day.
Just 2 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, what he meant was that he would write at least for 2 minutes, and then if it was going well, he'd keep going. And sometimes,
but the every day is the most important.
It was every
thing.
Day, but it was a good way to think about it, because then you're not sort of you don't get caught up in, am I writing enough? Is this going to take forever if I sit down and write? Just if you have 2 minutes, just sit down and do it. And so I started doing that after I heard him say that, give that advice, and you know, at first it really was 2 minutes, but then it would become 4 or 10. About 20, and just kind of worked it from there.
Do you write every day?
Yeah, I've been basically writing every day since then. I think it's the only way that I could do it, I think.
And what made you, I mean, what is it that gets you, I mean, I guess what I want to get at sort of the process of how you come up with an idea for the story. Do you have an idea and then start writing it and then, you know, figure out later how to hone it into a story, or do you start writing and see where it goes?
It's you know, I mean, I feel like I'm still learning, and I think anyone who says they know what they're doing is probably lying to you. But what I've been doing is writing, you know, I start writing and something happens, and just kind of follow it from there, which seems more organic to me. I don't think I could ever really start with an idea and then get into it. But actually, I started writing these stories when I had just a name, this name, Loris, and I wanted to write a story with a character named Loris, and then I just, these stories came out, I guess.
And so Loris, a lot of these stories, the narrator's voice is the brother of Loris.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So it kind of gives you a chance to have that distance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Loris is kind of, you know, you've got a lot about the relationship of brothers.
Right.
Which feels like you might have had that experience yourself.
Yeah, I definitely have a younger brother. It's funny, the book, it follows the general contours of my family structure in terms of one father, one mother, and one brother, not named Loris. But it doesn't feel very autobiographical to me, or to my brother, I think. But it's funny how you use some things from your life and change others.
Well, you do. I mean, you do use all of the places.
Mm.
You know, I want to talk about Marine Park because it's a place that I think a lot of people don't know. It's a, you know, I'd call it an obscure neighborhood to some people. Even in New York, people who live in New York don't know where Marine Park is, but you're in Brooklyn, pretty much the farthest away from Manhattan you can be.
Yeah.
Is that a fair description?
I would say it almost geographically is as far away from Manhattan as you can get.
Right. And socially
socially
and culturally also, very different.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, have you ever been to Rockaway Beach? I don't know if...
when I was a kid.
Yeah. That's it. When you drive to Rockaway Beach, you drive through Marine Park, basically, and over the Marine Parkway Bridge, which links Marine Park to Rockaway and Queens.
Right. So even for people who go to Rockaway as a kind of vacation, they don't really see Marine Park.
Oh, yeah, you totally miss it. It's the Belt Parkway and then Rockaway.
Right.
But it's right there, right out there on the tip of the borough. Just it's all water and land.
So weather is a big part of the experience, the ocean weather, even though it's an urban kind of place.
Yeah, I think it totally is. You definitely feel the weather more out there than you do in a skyscraper, for sure.
Right.
And you are so close to the water. It's funny, I was done with this book by the time Hurricane Sandy happened, but there's a story in here about a big storm that was a little bit like Sandy, really.
That's not the Martin story, is it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's called Palms, right. And about a storm that comes to the neighborhood. So it was kind of funny seeing that it sort of reminded me that Marine Park is hit by a lot of storms, I guess. I mean, as is New York always, but you definitely feel it a lot more in these sort of low-lying houses,
right,
and long avenues and blocks.
Yeah, and Sandy hit New York really hard. How did Marine Park?
You know, it's funny. It's actually a good story. Marine Park did very, very well because it's as low-lying as you can get, really, but it's protected by the natural barriers of the salt marshes and Rockaway Beach itself and the dunes.
So marshes doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, so it's actually a great argument for ecological conservation.
Yeah.
If, for example, Lower Manhattan had something like that, we'd be in much better shape.
That's right.
Marine Park was remarkably fine. Unlike Gerritsen Beach was a little bit harder hit, and parts of Coney Island and things like that.
More exposed and less protected.
Exactly, much less protected.
The feel of this book is very much like a, you know, childhood storytelling. I mean, I know from we've talked before that this is not strictly autobiographical, but it's in a way it's a way for you to express what this place is like, what it means to you, you know, through a lot of great characters, a lot of, you know, description of the area that it makes it come to life. One of the things I noticed is that the prevalence of cars, and you talk about that because most people think of New York as being Manhattan, even parts of the city that are not Manhattan. You can live without a car.
Right.
But in Marine Park, it's like you're in the suburbs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think basically most people have a car in Marine Park, or at least know how to drive one. It's pretty rare that you don't. And that's sort of a good example of the difference between Marine Park and other parts of the city, or even other parts of Brooklyn. And there's no other way to get around. You know, there are trains and buses, but they're very far away. You know, the bus lines are sort of the arteries that get you to and around Marine Park. And then otherwise it's a car, which I think actually makes it a little more, in some ways, similar to other parts of America, a little more central to the American experience.
Right. Yeah, less like the New York experience.
Right, right.
And I think some of the things that happen in some of those stories are things that people can relate to, you know, the learning to drive stories.
Right, right.
And, you know, just what it's like to be a teenager with a car.
Yeah,
like
exactly,
Which are fun. But you have, you know, there's more going on. It's not just about a kid view of growing up. You've got a lot of characters that express also kind of this feeling of disconnection. You know, you've got like the kid who grows up, who was really important in high school but doesn't know what to do after.
Sure.
You know, these are people that you know, we can recognize. You know, they feel real to us, but you're capturing who they really are.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I started writing these stories while I was not living in Marine Park anymore. I was actually writing them while I was in Switzerland. I was there for a couple summers playing baseball. It was a weird turn of events for me, but a pretty welcome one. And so there's that great A.S. Byatt quote that's something like, you know, summer is best described on a winter day or something like that, which right. was kind of how I felt about Marine Park while I was out there in Switzerland. I was in this beautiful hill country outside Zurich.
They have flat places to play baseball?
Yeah, they do. They do. Baseball in Switzerland is, yeah, it's a crazy, crazy experience.
Are Americans playing baseball in Switzerland or Swiss people playing baseball?
Yeah, you know, it's a full league out there. It's getting more and more professional every year. And it's usually each team is sort of headlined by one or two Americans right. who get over there. Some of them are paid. And then there's some who are just sort of college type
kids.
So
you were a college student
there.
When this
yeah,
was
I was the
on.
College type kid who was not getting paid. But, right.
Nice
family,
way to spend a summer.
It was great. But yeah, family that was friends of ours sort of invited me over.
So you were writing a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean,
you were alone.
I was alone.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you speak? I mean, people in Switzerland must speak some English.
Yeah, they do. Everyone speaks. It's funny though. The baseball games were like someone said this to me once that they're like a Spanish Armada naval battle. You know, because it was people would be. You'd be speaking German, French, Italian, and then the baseball players mostly spoke Spanish, you know, if they were coming over from the Dominican Republic or Puerto
right,
Rico or something.
Right. So did you learn some Spanish?
I knew Spanish was the only language I knew, so it was funny. That was what I used to communicate instead of the German.
Of course, it's baseball Spanish.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Right? So. Which is sort of Spanglish anyway.
Right. So do you still play baseball?
I do, yeah. Not as much as I used to. I wish I could go back out to Switzerland and be playing. Right. But
you live in New York now.
Yeah. I live in Cobble Hill in Brooklyn, which is sort of the opposite of Marine Park, geographically and culturally. Again.
So do you go back to Marine Park at all?
I do, yeah. My parents are still there, and I go visit a bunch.
And do you feel like, you know, do you think that people in Marine Park are going to read your book? Have you thought about that?
That's a good question.
And I have no idea. You know, it's sort of like, wow, this is a portrait of us. You know,
right.
It gives them a sort of meaningfulness, you know,
right.
that they're recognized. This is a real place. But then you're up against people saying, well, that's not how it really is. You know?
Right. I'm sure there'll be a lot of that's not how it really is.
Right. That didn't really happen.
Yeah, exactly. This is totally false.
Right. But then you have to say, this is fiction. It's
exactly.
It's not nonfiction.
It's very fictional, yeah. The only time I ever found Marine Park, the only time I ever came across it in my own reading was in the book Netherland by Joseph O'Neill.
Oh, yeah.
And which is a great book, and has this great fascination with cricket and cricket playing the sport of cricket in New York, and one of the places that the characters play cricket is Marine Park, which I totally recognized. That's happens for years and years, and I'm sure will continue to happen.
And who brought cricket to Marine Park? Would it be Jamaicans?
Yeah, I think it seemed. I would think. Yeah, not totally entirely sure, but yeah, just in the middle of the park and in the green oval, every Saturday and Sunday, it's just filled with cricket players in the you know all white uniforms.
Right.
It's really
oh,
pretty.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a nice melting pot too.
Have you ever played cricket?
No, I haven't. I should. It's a little intimidating. It's kind of scary.
Very different.
Yeah.
Really different.
Can't use a glove. It's kind of crazy, you know?
And the bat is, you know, the bat's sort of flat.
The bat is flat.
And it does, you know, people feel differently.
Oh, yeah.
The run, scorekeeping is insane.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
It's really different. And, of course, you run back and forth. You don't run around
right,
bases.
Right, exactly.
So.
Yeah, and then when in the summer, we'd be, my brother and I and our friends would be playing baseball on the softball fields in the, sort of on the edge of the oval. And then the cricket players would be playing in the middle, and we'd sort of trade stray hits and have
right.
to run onto each other's
foul
fields.
Balls
yeah,
and,
exactly.
Yeah. Right, and probably they don't like it.
They didn't like it too much, yeah.
So of all the stories in the book, and there's quite a few, there are a lot of stories. I mean, some of them are very, very short. Is there one that really you love the most above all? I mean, it's hard to say. You know, it's like having children, but
right.
just sort
it's like
of,
picking your favorite child
right.
or something.
Right.
I think that the one that was sort of most purely written was the very first one in the book called Heavy Lifting, which is about the two main characters shoveling snow.
I love that story.
Yeah, it's pretty short, but it's not as short as some of the others. And I basically wrote it in one sort of fell swoop, more or less, and then sort of edited it afterwards. But it was kind of, it sort of came out more or less intact. I think it was the most it might have been the truest experience in the book. I have such vivid memories of doing this, shoveling snow for money.
Sweetness to that.
Yeah.
That I think was, yeah, it was sort of, it's felt. It's a felt experience.
And it was sort of, it felt like the truest way into the neighborhood, sort of, the characters are wandering around while they're trying to get people to pay them to shovel snow, and they're sort of noticing a lot of things, and which felt like a truer way to see the neighborhood as opposed to, I don't know, driving around it or something.
All right. So everybody, I'm sure this is sort of almost trite, but who do you feel is the writer that influences you, or writers? I'm just sort of, who do you read and find thinking, I want to write that, I want to be that person?
Sure. Well, these days I'm working at a publishing company, so I do that every day as a new writer that I wish I was writing like. But for this collection in particularly, it's definitely Junot Diaz, who is just, I feel like I've just transposed his structure onto my own neighborhood. But Drown is one of my favorite books of all time. And really everything he's written, Oscar Wilde. Just an incredible writer.
Yeah, he's a terrific writer.
Yeah, and the same sort of use of childhood, but sort of the revision of it as you're writing, and this sort of close family structures. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've learned a lot from him, or I hope I have.
So do you want to keep going with the sense, exploring relationships in people you're close to growing up, or do you, have you mined that all, so
yeah,
enough?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. I mean, I think Junot Diaz spent, 10 years writing Oscar Wilde, and that started as a short story. So we'll see. We'll talk in 10 years,
I know. You have lots of time to figure this out. How about some of the writers that are identified as Brooklyn writers? Does that appeal to you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I was growing up as Brooklyn was kind of getting cooler in the sort of wider country. I mean, obviously it's had its moments for a long time, but when I was young was sort of the heyday of Michael Chabon and Jonathan Lethem, especially Chabon. I read everything he's ever written. Now I think everyone's kind of a Brooklyn writer, at least in some way. It's like how that M+1 essay and book, MFA versus NYC, how they say everyone's sort of tied to an MFA program in some way. Yeah. I think now everyone's tied to Brooklyn by at least, one step removed or something.
So how do you feel about, since you brought up the MFA, I think it's a fertile topic
for
discussion. I see both sides of the argument.
Yeah.
But it does feel like MFA programs can foster a kind of writing that is self-referential.
Yeah, sure. And sort of rote writing.
Yeah. And it, it feels unfair to those writers on some level to say that, because it's that's not really what they're, I don't think that's who they really are, but
yeah.
Do you ever feel like you want to go to a writing school, or do you want to stay away from them? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. I've sort of go back and forth about that. I mean, I think one of my favorite lines from that book, MFA vs. NYC, I think it's Alexander Chee's essay, where he has a line that's something like, everyone thinks that the ghost of Raymond Carver is standing over every MFA student's shoulder exhorting them to write the perfect story, but have you ever tried to write the perfect Raymond Carver story? It's a lot harder than it sounds. So I think a lot of what's being written out of MFA programs is not wrote at all, and there's all sorts of interesting people. I mean, Junot Diaz went to one himself.
Yeah. It could just be that, like anything else, there are really good writers.
Yeah.
And they stand out wherever they are, at an MFA program or not in an MFA program.
I think that's definitely true.
And it's probably fair to say there are some writers, there are a lot of writers who will not stand out.
Yeah.
They'd be really good, but maybe not great.
For sure,
And whether they're at an MFA program or not. So.
And everyone wants to be great.
Yeah, of course. And everyone wants to feel that what you're writing is heard and has an impact.
Yeah. I haven't... gone to an MFA program yet or applied to one, in part because I kind of like being in some semblance in the real world. It's kind of not that I'm in much of a real world at all at a publishing house, but
well, but in a lot of ways, you get all the benefits.
Yeah, you do.
You know, and you're getting
it's
paid.
True. Yeah, getting paid is nice. I mean, it's you know, who likes to wake up in the morning and go to a job? It's no fun, but that is what basically everyone who's reading your stories does. So right. It's good to have a sort of sense of what the regular man and woman is experiencing when they are getting ready to read.
Well, that's
which,
a good point.
Yeah, which changes the way you think about the purpose of reading and writing. And sometimes, and I wonder if maybe if you're in an MFA program, if sometimes you're convinced that everyone should be reading what you're writing all the time. And I think sometimes people don't have the patience for that.
Yeah. Well, and it may also be, and there are some people I know who have espoused this, that the experience of being a person in the world, in the and not to say that being in academia is not real, but it's more, it's a less commonly experienced modality.
Yeah,
you know, if,
sure.
So you're working, you have to get up in the morning and go to a job, and then you have to figure out when you can write.
Right.
That's
right.
It makes you part of the overall culture more.
Right.
Rather than being separated from it.
Yeah.
Now, there's benefits to being separated because then you have the ability to look from the outside.
Vantage point.
Yeah,
yeah,
a different vantage point.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the freedom to be able to write is really important.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get.
It's a real gift. Yeah.
Yeah, the time. It's just time. So if you work really hard all the time, you know, when do you write?
Yeah. It's not
so,
easy.
No. I mean, so that I think that must be a challenge for you. You have a job.
Yeah.
You're around writing, too, which is also complicated. You're dealing with other people's writing.
Yeah.
And so does that influence how you write, how you yourself write? Because the things you're reading are going to influence you on some level.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, the job I'm doing now is I'm a sort of small-time assistant editor at Vintage Books, the publishing house. And it is difficult. I mean, the great thing about the job is that you go to work every day and basically you're being paid to read new books that are coming in and think about ways to bring attention back to old ones. And we have a lot of really good ones on both sides. The downside, of course, is that, you know, when you're reading Willa Cather, you think, why am I trying? Let's just let Willa Cather say what she needs to say.
Right.
It's worked so far for me where I sort of wake up in the morning, do my own writing, and then go to work and try not to think about my own stuff for the rest of the day. And, you know, sometimes that's frustrating where you get to work and you think, oh, man, I wish I could have put in 2 more hours today or something. And you kind of feel pulled back to your writing. But it's kind of nice to be pulled out of it and pulled out of your own head and into real concerns. I work on a lot of nonfiction, so I do feel like that keeps me grounded a little bit better to see kind of the ideas that people are thinking about, journalism, politics, the world of the real world around us.
Right. No, that's interesting. So do you ever have a moment when you've read something in the course of work that's really so great that you think, and it inspires you to start writing something right away?
Yeah.
Have you ever had that experience where, you know, even you're at work, you know, so if you stole a few minutes to write something down, you know, it's not really part of work. But on the other hand, I mean, have you ever felt that?
For sure. Let's you know, preface this by saying if my bosses are listening to this, you know, never, ever. No, but I think that's a pretty common experience for people who are trying to write, which I'm trying to do, that you kind of pull up that blank Microsoft Word document at your desk and toss in a couple paragraphs and then pull it back down again.
So do the people you work with, they know you're a writer? And
more or less. I think the cat's sort of out of the bag. The great thing about publishing, and I think media and journalism generally, is that most people are closet writers and readers and are trying to be writing and thinking about writing a lot. So it's been a nice experience talking about writing and writing processes with the other editors and assistants at the company.
Well, probably most of them have either manuscripts that they're working on or stories.
Everyone's
or something.
Got it in the back pocket.
Right.
You know.
So how did you get from writing these stories to getting published? What was the process that, that caused that to happen?
It was a lot of really lucky coincidences. I had a great teacher in college, Amy Hempel, who's an incredible writer, and also, I guess people don't know this as well, but she's just an incredible teacher, one of the best, and she sort of helped me a lot with the writing of this collection. And I guess I'd written about half of it while I was in college, and she had sort of encouraged me to keep writing and to finish it up. And I think that it's helpful when you go out, sort of the first step to publishing a book is finding an agent once you've written the book, once the writing is all done. And it's helpful when you're looking for an agent to have something full to show them. If you send them, you know, a half-finished story, they're going to say, thanks, but no thanks. You know, I have to go on a lunch date. But if you can send them a full, semi-complete book, it's a little more interesting and the ball is more in your court. So I was lucky enough to have this full manuscript, or more or less full, and was also lucky that it was connected, that it was kind of, it absolutely wasn't a novel, but the stories sort of had...
linked
stories. Yeah, there was a link. Yeah. There were links, and they kind of made sense together, as opposed to, I think, the other thing is that most people try to publish their books of stories that are just everything they've written so far sort of scraped together. And that was totally this, but I was lucky enough that everything that I've scraped together kind of fit into similar themes.
And so that's how you sent this around?
Yeah, it was actually just one really incredible agent who took a chance on me sort of at the start of her career, more or less, I guess, as well. And she's just... she's been my number one advocate since the beginning, which is nice.
It's always good to have an advocate. Yeah. I think that's right. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about, there's a story in here, which is, I can't remember the name of it, but it's, it's called Clean, mm-hmm. where you sort of matter-of-factly trace an outbreak or the passing of herpes, you know, from person to person. And it's a really, I thought, powerful story in its sort of matter-of-factness.
Right.
And I'm just curious, like, where did that come from?
It's funny, I'd been reading a lot of Roberto Bolaño sort of while I was writing this collection, and none of it really affected the collection at all. I mean, for a long time, really everything that I was writing that didn't end up in this collection was sort of bad Bolaño pastiche and just kind of terrible, terrible stuff about the road and trips, places, and weird people that you meet. And it just, I was finding it really suffocating that I couldn't sort of get his voice out of my head, but everything that I was doing in that voice just wasn't sort of cohering. And then I sort of moved on to different things. And then maybe a couple months later, I guess, I think I'd finished Savage Detectives maybe 6 months before, and I started writing this story, and suddenly it sort of clicked for me. I think you needed a subject sort of to let that kind of manic but matter-of-fact voice just let it just kind of roll through you. Bolaño's sort of the master at that kind of shock and awe but also matter-of-fact tone.
Right. Oh, that was great. Yeah. It was a good influence for you. I think it's a terrific story.
It's also a good way to the tracing of a disease is a good way. Disease of some sort is a good way of, again, kind of getting a picture of a neighborhood or a time period. In the same way that walking around from house to house trying to shovel is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Hadn't thought of that. There's a kind of continuity there.
Yeah, a good organizational.
Yeah. Because the virus invades lives.
Right, exactly.
And you're kind of following the weird way that it goes.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. I really like that story.
Yeah. And you get sort of weird snapshots of each person's life.
Yeah. I like the end too.
Don't spoil it.
I won't. So I really want to thank you for talking to me. This has
no
been
problem.
Great. I love this book. It's called Marine Park. It's a collection of stories. The author is Mark Chiasano. And this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Thank you for coming, Mark.
Thanks a lot, David.